Guest today is Kathy Day. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you, Glenn. Lovely to be here.
Now, Kathy, would you like to tell us why you are here? In other words, introduce yourself and what we're going to talk about.
Thanks. I'm part of the Field Epidemiology in Action team. We teach epidemiology to public health officials in Papua New Guinea and other areas. And when I'm not working in Papua New Guinea, I'm living in beautiful Tuggeranong.
And that's why you're here. So as what you try to do on the program, we get in the voices of Tuggeranong, and normally they're people whose focus is in Tuggeranong, but this time we're looking a little bit further afield, and specifically today, and we'll start off, Kathy's been to a number of different places, but today we'll start off talking about the work that you're doing in Papua New Guinea. So would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So field epidemiology is what they describe as being a disease detective, which is going around and trying to figure out what sort of diseases are happening and how you can combat them. In a place like Papua New Guinea, you can't go and just do an MRI or take a blood test or whatever. In most of the areas in Papua New Guinea, there is no way that you can actually diagnose a disease accurately, and you have to go on symptoms. Mm-hmm. So what we do is teach public health officials how to do surveillance, which in this case means to detect the different kinds of symptoms, and then how to respond to outbreaks, and then how to report that, and then how to prepare for the next outbreak. Mm. That's kind of the short description.
So it's building capability in PNG, isn't it? And it matters because PNG is our nearest neighbour. Really, it's the distance across Torres Strait is between the top of Cape York and the bottom of PNG is very small.
Yes, you can see Australia from PNG and vice versa. Yeah.
So even though it might be quite a way away from our part of Australia, it is our closest neighbour. So that is quite important, and building that capability is important. So you're not going in and actually treating the people that are suffering from the various diseases. It's building capability amongst the local officials. So when you leave, the benefit is still there.
That's right. And so we run three different programs, and on one of those programs, actually 95% of the actual teaching is done by local people. Mm. And that's our plan for all of them, is all of the programs, is that eventually we'll be able to, move out. There'll be a strong group of trained officials and we can move on to other things.
So how long has this program been running, and how much longer has it got to go?
So the intermediate field epidemiology training program has been running 10 years, which is why we now have enough people on the ground who can actually run the program. I would expect we would continue for about another 2 years till we finally hand everything over, and it'll be run out of the National Department of Health. It's already run out of the National Department of Health, but they won't need our technical assistance to do that. Mm. But we also run two other programs, and one of them is called Frontline One Health. I don't know if you heard the expression One Health. It's basically what it's saying is that, human health and animal health and environmental health are all connected. Mm. And you can't just go around jabbing people with needles if you're not also thinking about, what are the environments that they're living in, where are the waterborne diseases, what kind of animals they're with, and those sorts of things. So the Frontline One Health program, that's only been running in PNG for a couple of years now, so we're some ways off being able to completely hand that over, although we're quite far advanced in that. Mm. And then finally, there's the rapid response team training. So a rapid response team is to deal with any emergency. So it could be a volcanic eruption, could be tribal warfare, could be an outbreak of disease, could be a landslide. And those teams are not just health people, but, you've got your admin people, your transport people, your security people and all those sorts of things.
So that's three programs. Would you have an idea of roughly how many people you've trained or the programs have trained over that time? Not you specifically, but those programs in total?
So the intermediate program, it's about 121 people have been trained to date. And as I say, they're about ready now to hand them over. They're quite intensive programs. So the intermediate program runs for about 9 months. Mm. So we would only get through about 15 graduates a year for the intermediate program. On the other hand, frontline and RRT, you're talking more like 20 to 30 people per program, and if we get the funding, we can run a couple of programs a year, so a lot higher there.
So you're training these people both as practitioners and as teacher practitioners or trainer practitioners. as well. Okay. Now, the training itself, is that, does that all take place in Port Moresby, or is it spread around the country?
It depends. So the intermediate program certainly takes place in Port Moresby, and we've got to do that because the people who are who we're training have actually got jobs up in the Highlands or down on the coast or whatever. And so we need to take them out of the workplace to be able to do the training. They select a project of interest to them and of importance in their area, and then we take them through how to do a study to determine what is the problem, then hopefully come up with some sort of solution. We call that an intervention. And then how to assess the intervention. So a classic example is a particular village where one of our participants had noticed there was extremely high rate of diarrheal disease. So he did the study. You know, is this a public health problem? Yes, it is. You know, what is the basic cause of the problem? Well, all of these people were living at the top of a mountain. It's extremely mountainous, PNG. But all the water source was down at the bottom. And so people had to carry the water to the top. And so nobody was washing their hands, you know, either before or after cooking or before or after using the toilet. So that was his public health problem. And then the solution was he introduced what's called a tippy tap. And a tippy tap is basically a jerry can with some holes in it slung over a tree with a foot pedal that you can operate. And so, sure, you still had to carry the water to the top. But it made washing your hands very, very simple. So once he'd installed that, he was then able to come back and then work out the number of diarrheal conditions afterwards. And it was vastly reduced. So that's the kind, it's a very practical sort of training. So you're right, they have to come to Port Moresby, but they're doing their projects in their local community, wherever that is.
And the training facility itself, is that, I mean, I have a mental picture here of people sitting in a nice clinical type classroom with all of the AV gear, the sort of thing we're used to here. Is that the environment that you're operating in up there?
If only. When we're doing the training, we often, we always have to go out of like the immediate area of Port Moresby to be somewhere that's a little bit isolated. And so we will usually hire a meeting room and somewhere that people can stay. They're called dongas. You know, donga is like a little cabin. So it's a bit more like being in a mining camp than anything else. So it's definitely not luxurious, but it certainly suits the purposes that that we have.
Now, I imagine collecting stats and data about success rates and whatever in PNG has got its own challenges, but are you able to sort of quantify just the impact of this program in terms of improved, you know, health outcomes, whether it's lifespan, longevity of life, or cure instances of disease outbreaks? Is that quantifiable?
Not yet is probably the best answer. Papua New Guinea is a place that we don't even know how many people there are. The last census failed, and all we know is there are somewhere between 9 million people and 17 million people. You know, that we just really don't know how, nobody knows how many people there are. It's the reporting mechanisms are extremely poor, and there's very little, you know, transport between places and so on. So it's really, really hard to quantify. What we can quantify for individual projects that have been completed is, you know, there's been a drop in this or a rise in that, depending on what it is we're measuring. But it's not possible now to be able to say that there is a reduced death rate or anything like that, or a reduced hospitalisation rate, because quite frankly, most people don't go to hospital there. It's an extremely rural environment.
What about anecdotal evidence, the feedback from the practitioners that you're dealing with? Are they sort of providing any sort of anecdotal feedback or accounts?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's what they call anecdata. It's not really data, but we're certainly, getting the feedback, because these people are actually in their communities working as surveillance officers or whatever their particular public health role is. And you can see the work that's being done by the individual officers in the area and the reporting back in it. But I couldn't quantify that. I couldn't say there's been a such and such a percent drop. And what's really interesting now is that there's a currently a polio outbreak, as you would have heard, I guess, in Morobe province. And it's been fantastic to be able to see the response to that just roll out exactly the way it should. It's quite common to communicate via WhatsApp in PNG, and so we're part of WhatsApp groups, and you can see the people going out and doing the surveillance and doing the testing and the interviews, and so yes, that's anecdotes, I guess, but you can see that the system is working really well, and that's not down to just our training. It's actually the commitment of the National Department of Health to improving the health of its own citizens.
Now, is this part? These things obviously cost money to do this, and you know, just getting the trainers, you know, up there as well as you know, accommodating people up there. So, is this part of an international program, or is this an Australian Aid program that's paying for this?
It's essentially Australian Aid. So, DFAT runs a program called Partnerships for a Healthy Region, and they fund multiple programs throughout the Pacific and Southeast Asia, and so yeah, we're 100% funded through DFAT through their Australian Aid program PHR. Yeah.
And so, how many of you go up when you do go, and how long do you go for at a time?
So typically, it would only be two of us, the funny foreigners coming from Australia, and all the other training and all the resources and so on are there on the ground. So I'm heading off to PNG again in a couple of weeks, where it will be a lot warmer than it is in Tuggeranong, and I'll be there with one other person and just stay for a couple of weeks and then come back. The idea is that ultimately we can hand over, and we've just appointed three new people on the ground in Port Moresby, and hopefully they will end up staying there forever, we hope.
And how do you find the personal experience going up there? What's sort of life in PNG like for you as an individual?
It's unusual. So Port Moresby, unfortunately, is one of the most violent and dangerous places in the world to be. And so we can't do things like go for an evening walk or, you know, that sort of thing. We'll either live in an apartment, which is inside a compound, or stay in a hotel, depending on exactly where we are, or stay in the Dongas if we're, you know, a little bit further out from Port Moresby. So you don't get a lot of the flavour of the local community, because in Port Moresby it's just too dangerous. However, other team members are in different places, and there's a little bit more freedom going elsewhere. But I spent most of 2023 in Afghanistan with Doctors Without Borders, and, you know, it's all different ideas of being confined, but we certainly were confined to barracks there.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other topic. But before we do that, as I said, we're going to mix it up this morning, and I asked Kathy to pick a few songs that she thought might have and somehow reflected on the work that she does or her experience with these things. And so we might have the first one of those, and that's, do you want to tell us about that one? Do you want to announce that?
Yeah. So that's called A Sweet Lullaby by Deep Forest. And for those of us of a certain age might remember it as the SBS theme song of a number of years ago. And they would often play the music video of that. And whilst the music video showed the whole world, as in a little girl going through the whole world, this is actually a traditional song from the Solomon Islands, where we also work. And it's basically a lullaby, and it's about an older brother comforting his younger brother who has, because their parents have died. I should warn you, there's about a 15-second of almost silence at the beginning, and I promise your radio hasn't stopped working.
No, maybe there might be the odd little comment as we go through that, so that we know, because as those of us who are sitting here making sure that there is no silence, that can always be a little bit unnerving, and because this one hasn't been trimmed at all. But let's hear Deep Forest with Sweet Lullaby. Not quite silence.
I promise that after 20 seconds it'll kick in with the music.
It's quite restful. Seagulls are not figuring too much at the moment out there. More snow on the Brindabellas this morning than seagulls at the beach. All right, so here's Deep Forest with Sweet Lullaby.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Deep Forest with Sweet Lullaby. So Deep Forest is a French musical group, and that song first appeared on their eponymous album in 1992. And as Kathy mentioned before, it was recorded in the Solomon Islands. It comes from there initially, and it made it into the top 30 in many European and Oceanic countries. And yeah, the music video was filmed across 8 separate countries, and again, as Kathy mentioned, it depicts the voyage of a young girl who travels the world by tricycle, and it was on the SBS ad many years ago. Now, the other Solomon Islands connection that we didn't mention when we were speaking before is that Kathy's work also goes on in the Solomon Islands, so let's touch on that again.
Yes, I should. I know I talked a lot about PNG. I guess that's where I spend most of my time. But the team actually works in Solomon Islands and Vanuatu as well, and to a lesser extent in Fiji and Timor-Leste. So we're doing the same sorts of things, initially setting up the intermediate field epidemiology training program in those places, with the ultimate aim of handing over to the ministries of health in those relevant countries.
Okay, so that's some really valuable work going on around the place. It's not the full extent of the aid work that happens that the Australian government does around the Pacific, but it is important work that affects people's lives in the most direct way possible. Now, Afghanistan got a mention before because Kathy likes to go to places where there's a little bit of a challenge and spent a little bit of time in Afghanistan. So there's a whole other story. So let's kick off there. Why were you in Afghanistan?
A whole other story indeed. I worked for Doctors Without Borders, Medicine Sans Frontières, or MSF, and was stationed in Bamiyan, which is in the central provinces, I guess, up in the mountains. Much colder than Canberra, gets down to minus 30 degrees there, and people consider it a heat wave if it gets up to about 20, but that's a whole other story. So what we were doing was building basic health centres. Afghanistan's got, amongst the worst health facilities in the world. The maternal mortality rate is up there with unfortunately the worst. And so the idea was initially we were building health centres for mothers and we put midwives there. But what we discovered rapidly as soon as these were built is that this was the only medical attention that was available there. So the midwife was finding, like a 60-year-old man would come along with pneumonia or a 12-year-old boy with a broken arm or whatever. And so she can't just turn them away. And therefore, we had to change the program based on, the feedback from the community. And therefore, we introduced nurses as well. Now, Afghanistan is incredibly gendered. And so basically, if you're a woman, you would see the midwife. And if you're a man, you would see the nurse. The nurse was male. And they had separate entrances. And the idea was that you couldn't even see who was going in and out each side of the clinic. It was incredibly rewarding. The people there were just so thrilled to have even the most basic level of treatment. And as I say, we trained the people, we built the facilities, and then ultimately that will be handed over to the local health authorities.
Now, that wasn't a fly-in, fly-out job like PNG is, was it?
No, I was there for most of 2023. And so it was a completely different way of living life. We lived in a compound, but everybody in Afghanistan lives in a compound. Like, it's just the way the community is organised with those giant walls you would have seen on TV and things, that everyone is inside a walled compound. For us, we basically lived and worked in the compound and then went out to the villages. And when we went out to the villages to where the centres were being built, we would have to be, you would have to take all sorts of precautions. So, you were always with 2 vehicles. We had satellite phones. The vehicles were placed a certain distance apart so that if one of them did encounter any kind of difficulty, then the other one hopefully wouldn't be affected by that one as well. Mm. And of course, we had to obey the extremely strict rules of the Taliban in terms of what clothing we wore and who sat where in the vehicles and all of those sorts of things. So it was extremely challenging, but extremely worthwhile.
Okay, so, I mean, being there for 12 months, that's really a long time to settle into an area and become part of the rhythm of life, as it were, and completely different experience to living here in good old Tuggeranong. Was there anything that surprised you while you were over there that, you know, thought I wouldn't have expected that, or I would have thought things would have been different from that? Was there anything that really sticks with you as being out of left field?
Well, for me, it was, I guess, the defiance of the local people in the face of the Taliban. The area that I was in is Bamyan. It's a Shia area, and the Taliban don't believe that Shias are real Muslims. That's their words, not mine. And so the people of Bamyan tend to view the Taliban as an occupying force. And it was interesting in the little ways that they pushed back. So music was illegal, but whenever there was a wedding, they would play music loudly so the entire valley could hear it. And I just thought that was a lovely way of resistance. And even things like women's hairdressers were also banned and, illegal. And in our local area where we lived, you know, a woman set up a Quranic study group, theoretically, with a curtain down the back. But in fact, the studying of the Quran was happening in the front and the hairdressing was happening in the back. And I just loved it was those little acts of resistance that I was surprised that they were willing to do that, given the consequences to them.
Yeah, sort of adapt to the circumstances any way they can. Now, that wasn't scripted, but that segues very nicely into another dimension. We were going to talk about music, because for those who have seen the news this morning, you would have seen the King's Birthday Honours have come out, and one of our local Canberran residents who was honoured in the King's Birthday Honours was Fred Smith. Now, we were talking before, you haven't met Fred Smith, but you know Fred Smith, or you know of him, or you went to something where he performed. So do you want to give a little bit of a story about who Fred Smith is and why we're talking about him now?
Sure. So Fred Smith got his gong for his diplomacy and his music, which is a really unusual combination. So he was a diplomat in Afghanistan and was down in Uruzgan province, which is down the south. Whereas I was up in the north, and he was there originally during the time of the American occupation, if you like, and worked closely there with the Australian soldiers. And he made music there and was able to connect to local people through the music. Then when he left, and he came back at the time after just before the evacuation of Kabul, and he worked there again. So he made some fantastic music. He made The Dust of Uruzgan and The Sparrows of Kabul is the show that I saw him at. So if you ever get the chance to see Fred Smith perform, I thoroughly recommend it. Like I said, I've never met him, but I feel our paths should have crossed, because he also served in Bougainville, and I served in Bougainville during the Civil War there as well. But I think we're going to hear one of his songs.
We will. So congratulations, Fred Smith, on that well-deserved award, and all the other great Canberrans and Australians who received those awards today. And I don't have The Dust of Uruzgan, but I do have a song of Fred Smith that I've played previously. It's a lovely song called Come and Say Goodnight. Is Fred Smith.
If it's light upon Sunday, and you find you cannot sleep, with your hopeful heart still hungry, come and say goodnight to me. And if you're in a contradictions have now brought good night to you. through these quiet suburban streets. None of us live here without a care. Not you, my friend, nor me. So if these latter years find you in some need of company, won't you close the door behind you and come say good night to me?
And that was Fred Smith with Come and Say Goodnight. That's a lovely little number, that one. And congratulations again to Fred and all the others who have been honoured in the Australia Day honours. Quite a lot of academics and people who have gone above and beyond their paid employment to contribute to the quality of the community that we live in. So thanks very much for your efforts. Now, the last little segment we'll have with Kathy, we're going to go back to PNG. And she mentioned earlier there was a polio outbreak on there. So perhaps if you could just give a very quick snapshot of what polio is for those who aren't of an age to remember what polio is. It was a big deal, certainly, years ago, but younger people may have heard of it but wouldn't really know what it's about. So what is polio and why is it such a big deal, and certainly in PNG?
Sure. So polio is a disease caused by the polio virus. Mm-hmm. And those of us of a certain age will remember that it was once widespread throughout the world, and it causes paralysis in some people. It's only a minority of people who actually get paralysis, and it's only a minority of those that die. And so unfortunately with polio, most of the people who get it are asymptomatic, which means that they can spread it, and it's extremely transmissible. Now, it's only been since the 50s and 60s when we've had, the Salk and then the Sabin vaccine has been introduced. There's been a massive drop worldwide in polio cases. Mm-hmm. And the only two places in the world where it is endemic now, which means that it's still running wild, are Pakistan and Afghanistan. They're the only two places in the world. So theoretically, Papua New Guinea was declared polio-free back in 2000, I think it was. And unfortunately, they've now had a new outbreak. The polio vaccine is extremely effective, but Papua New Guinea has one of the lowest rates of vaccination in the world for polio and other things. And so this is what we've discovered, is that that because of the low vaccination rates, the outbreak has commenced in Morobe province, but there is evidence that it's also in Port Moresby. And so what occurs is that our, the rapid response teams and the go out, and the public health officers go out and conduct their surveys. They will ask people questions about what's called acute flaccid paralysis. So basically when people's legs don't work is possibly the simplest explanation. So they go around and just ask the questions of everybody in the villages and so on. And then once they get information about that, then perhaps they can take samples and then send them off for testing. But it's not like a place like Tuggeranong where, there's very, very high rates of vaccination and people are protected even if you're not vaccinated because all your neighbours are vaccinated. Mm-hmm. That's not the case in Papua New Guinea. And, of course, sanitation is another thing. Here in Tuggeranong, we've got amazing sanitation. We've got clean water coming out of the taps. We have toilets that flush. And none of that is available routinely in the remote areas of Papua New Guinea.
So how's it spread?
So it's what's called the fecal-oral route. So basically, somehow or other, getting from poos into mouths. And that might be things like people going to the toilet and then not washing their hands and then cooking food or handling food. And I mentioned before about the tippy-tap thing, about how crucial hand-washing is. But it's not part of a lot of cultures. And so So you can absolutely reduce the rate of polio transmission just by improving sanitation and encouraging hand washing. But vaccines are the gold standard.
I think I still remember the vaccine, that little spoon with the little sweet pink fluid on it that you lined up in primary school and got your mouth full of that. And I can still see that very vividly, even though it's a long, long time ago. So, and it is important because it does affect, you know, people get the polio. And one of my neighbours when I was younger had polio as a younger person, had an arm that was, you know, only had limited use because of that. It had been paralysed. So this is, you know, affecting people's quality of life, and it's so preventable. So
And as you rightly said, you know, they're quite close neighbours to us, and there's been genetic testing of the samples in Morobe province, and it turns out it's the same one. It's identical to the one that's currently circulating in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. So for, you know, so it's crossed that border because viruses don't care about borders. And so it wouldn't be too much effort for it to cross the border into Australia, but we're protected by our high vaccination rates and great sanitation.
Excellent. Now, that somehow takes us to our next piece of music, our next song that Kathy has chosen, and it's Hunters and Collectors and Holy Grail. What's the connection?
Well, I guess for me, one of the connections was this: we had a very limited playlist when I was serving in Bougainville during the Civil War, and this was one of them. So I've always associated that song with Bougainville. The song is about, you know, reaching for the Holy Grail, you know, trying to find something that's unachievable, and about sort of loss on the way. When Glenn asked me to choose a couple of songs for this, I actually looked it up at the origins and discovered the song is based on Napoleon's attack on Moscow in 1812. There you go. I had no idea, which kind of makes sense when they talk about hiding in the snow. But I love the idea about it's everybody getting together and being defeated and things going badly, but still they kept the faith and kept going. Didn't end well for Napoleon, though.
No, and the other allegory is for hunters and collectors, the Holy Grail was them trying to crack into the US market, obviously where all the money is, a much bigger market than Australia. It's also an AFL anthem for obvious reasons, because that cup is certainly the Holy Grail for them. Interestingly, it was ranked number 30 on Triple M's Ozzest 100 songs. So it goes back to 1992. Here's Hunters and Collectors and the Holy Grail.
Woke up this morning from the strangest dream. I was in the biggest army the world has ever seen. We were marching as one on the road to the Holy Grail. Fortune and glory, it's a short song, but it's a hell of a story when you spend your lifetime trying to get your hands on the Holy Grail. But have you heard about the Great Crusade? We ran into millions and nobody got paid. Yeah, we raised four corners of the globe for the Holy Grail. All the locals scattered, they were hiding in the snow. We were so far from home, so how were we to know? There'd be nothing left to plunder when we stumble on the Holy.
Okay, so that was Hunters and Collectors with Holy Grail. So a little bit of user error there. I hit the button too many times and it disappeared, but we got there in the end. Okay, so I've been having a very interesting conversation with Kathy Day about all matters to do with PNG, Bougainville, Solomon Islands, Afghanistan. We've ranged across a lot more territory than we normally do on Monday Lunchbox. So thanks, Kathy. It's been great having you in here.
Fantastic. It's been wonderful.